This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
At the moment, there are pretty heavy concentrations of police officers at flashpoints on highways across the country, trying to prevent further violence.
That's reporter Darren Taylor on how South Africa is trying to prevent further attacks on foreign truck drivers employed in the country. Details coming up also. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres meets with DRC President Felix Tshisekedi today. And Pope Francis arrives in Mozambique Wednesday to start a week-long three-country trip. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, there's tension on several major highways in South Africa today as local truck drivers protest against the employment of foreigners in the trucking industry. South Africa's Road Freight Association, which represents many transport companies, says more than 200 foreign-born truckers have been killed by unknown attackers since March 2018. Reporter Darren Taylor in Johannesburg spoke with my colleague Paul Alexander.
There's been chaos on the roads across South Africa, various trucks blocking highways, of course resulting in the inevitable traffic jams. Then there have also been police reports of assaults on truck drivers, and at this stage it would appear mostly South African truck drivers who've carried on working, who initially didn't take part in the blocking of the highways or bring their vehicles to a halt to show solidarity with this shadowy group that seems to be behind this mobilization against the employment of foreign truck drivers. I know that in the early hours of this morning, a number of trucks were also petrol bombed at various spots in South Africa. At the moment, there are pretty heavy concentrations of police officers at flashpoints on highways across the country, trying to prevent further violence. Understandably, the truck drivers, who are mostly from countries like Zimbabwe and Malawi, who are also mostly working legally in South Africa, are lying pretty low. They're in fear of their lives, naturally. As in little more than a year, scores of their colleagues have been murdered. They've, for example, been burned alive in their vehicles, shot and stabbed.
So can you talk about other anti-foreigner actions and why they are flaring up so often in South Africa?
It's mostly got to do with employment. You know, this is happening in a country that's just released record high unemployment rates. It stands now at almost 30%. There are, in fact, 10 million people of working age who can't find jobs. It's also happening in a country where violence seems to be the default setting because the government often doesn't respond to anything else. In this context, it's easy to realize why foreign nationals who do have jobs, even if they carry the legal documents to indeed be employed, would be attacked. I've spoken to owners of transport companies, and they employ quite a few truck drivers from Zimbabwe. They say it's in their interests to employ Zimbabweans rather than South Africans because they say the Zimbabweans don't go on strike all the time. These guys also insist that they're paying the foreigners on the same level as they would South Africans. Also, the South African truck company bosses don't have to pay those foreign drivers any benefits.
So what are local authorities doing to protect foreigners?
The police and traffic officers are out in force today across the country, as I've said. The foreign truck drivers obviously argue that this isn't happening to protect their lives, but rather to protect the South African economy. There may well be some justification in their claim. The South African government insists that xenophobia isn't at the heart of this matter, but that's almost impossible to believe given that the Truckers Foundation is so clearly targeting foreign workers. There is, however, a clear raising of the level of concern by the South African government over what's happening. I know that the ministers of employment and labor, police, transport and home affairs all met last night to discuss this issue. What is strange, though, is that they continue to insist that this isn't xenophobia. It's criminal and economic sabotage. They deny criticism that they aren't doing enough to prevent the attacks on trucks, whether they are driven by foreigners or not. They point out that 91 people have been arrested following the attacks. But it's clear that transport companies are now frightened of employing foreigners here in South Africa. A lot have cancelled their work contracts. These companies are also putting up signs outside their premises to the effect that there are no longer any vacancies for foreign nationals.
That was a reporter Darren Taylor in Johannesburg speaking with VOA's Paul Alexander. Pope Francis arrives Wednesday in Mozambique to start a week-long three-country trip with a focus on the saving the environment, fighting corruption, easing poverty, and fostering peace. On his second visit to sub-Saharan Africa, the Pope's arrival comes a month after Mozambique's government signed a historic peace treaty with the former rebel group RENAMO to end a 16-year-old civil war, and 6 months after back-to-back cyclones killed more than 1,000 people. Deforestation has hit both Mozambique and Madagascar hard. Reports say Madagascar has lost about 44% of its forests over the past 60 years, while Mozambique has lost 8 million hectares, about the size of Portugal, since the 1970s. Both are among the world's poorest countries. The Pope will spend his last day in Mauritius, a small island state known for its beaches and tax treaties that anti-poverty campaigners say drain the wealth from developing nations. The new year in Cameroon begins today with the government determined to reopen at least 4,500 schools that have been closed in its English-speaking regions due to the separatist crisis. But the separatists have warned they will not allow any school to open unless their leader, Ayuk Tabi, and nine others, given life jail sentences by a military tribunal, are freed. They have already attacked and wounded at least nine teachers for defying their instructions. Moki Edwin Kenzaka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
28-year-old teacher Elma Tabot and her two children arrived in Cameroon's capital Yaoundé from the English-speaking southwestern town of Menji on Monday. She says she is one of the nine teachers who were abducted and beaten by separatist fighters, with some of them having their fingers chopped off.
Our house was burned, and a business place that we were managing was burned. So even the transport fare to come here, it was really difficult. Things were really hard. People helped us to raise the money that we can reach here. So I've gone through a lot of difficulties.
Tabot says they were accused of defying instructions by separatists for them not to go to school to prepare the opening of the 2019-2020 school year in Cameroon. The separatists had on social media vowed that schools will not resume in the English-speaking regions until their leader Ayuk Tabe Julius and nine of his supporters, given life sentences by a military tribunal in Yaoundé, are freed. The tribunal said it had found them guilty of secession, terrorism, and hostility against the state of Cameroon. Deben Chofo, governor of Cameroon's English-speaking northwest region, says the population should not be intimidated and should send their children to school. He says all measures have been taken to protect both teachers and school children.
The security services assured the population that all is set for class resumption. I'm appealing, therefore, to the population of our region that they should send back their children to school. To those that have attempted to send their children elsewhere, to bring them back.
Violence erupted in Cameroon's English-speaking regions in 2016 when teachers and lawyers protested alleged discrimination at the hands of the French-speaking majority. The government responded with a crackdown that sparked an armed movement for an independent English-speaking state. The separatists started attacking schools and kidnapping teachers and students, vying to make the regions ungovernable by the central government in Yaoundé. Laurent Serge Etuningwa, Cameroon Minister of Basic Education, says the war is completely paralyzing education in the English-speaking regions.
The 4,482 écoles sont...
Etuningwa says more than 4,482 nursery and primary schools in the English-speaking regions have either been closed, transformed as training grounds for separatist fighters, or completely destroyed. He says more than 6,000 teachers and 201,000 school children are today directly affected by the separatist war. Before this Monday's schools reopening, the Cameroon government dispatched English-speaking elites who joined traditional rulers and the clergy to ask the population to send their children to school. One of them, Asheri Vivian Kilo from the Northwest region, says local councils have been handed funds to reconstruct some of the damaged schools.
Councils have credits to build and refurbish schools. Of course, the military is taking care of getting the separatists out of the school campuses that have been occupied. We understand that children have been displaced to Yaoundé. They stay with families that were not expecting them, and they needed to be assisted.
Tens of thousands of people, especially students and teachers, have been deserting Cameroon's conflict-prone English-speaking regions following renewed fighting provoked by the life jail sentences given the separatist leaders last August 21. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
17 past the hour, you were listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres meets with DRC President Felix Tshisekedi today as part of a three-day visit in support of the fights against Ebola and extremism. Guterres earlier visited Beni, the focus of anti-Ebola efforts, amid an outbreak that has killed more than 2,000 people in an area that is a conflict hotspot. He urged local militias to choose peace instead of violence. He also went to Goma, a major city on the Rwanda border where the virus recently spread. The UN chief said the agency is fully on the side of the Congolese people in fighting Ebola, along with measles, malaria, and cholera. Guterres said he also supports the armed forces of the DRC in the fight against terrorism, which represents a threat not only for the Congo, but the whole of Africa. African nations in recent years have been encouraged to expand their tax bases, such as increasing taxes on mining companies and multinational corporations. But with more African consumers and companies shifting toward mobile payment systems, governments are looking to tax transactions done on mobile phones. There are warnings, however, that such taxes could hurt digital growth for the continent. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
More and more African countries are taxing digital platforms and mobile money transfers to fund economic development. Nigeria is the latest country to join the trend with a new 5% tax on items bought online. It wants banks to deduct the tax from online transactions for the government. Segun Abiona is the founder of Nicole and Giovanni, a Nigerian company that sells men's accessories. He says more taxes will reduce the gains he has made.
It's the form of double taxation on us, because if you tax every transaction that come online, we still end up paying taxes, which is 5% of VAT, more or less 5% of every sales that we make in terms of VAT. It's going to discourage a lot of internet purchase, knowing fully well that we are fully grown in terms of the online space. We're still trying to encourage more people to shop online, and at the same time eradicate the fear of people having to get scammed online.
According to some business analysts, at least 100 million people on the continent use mobile financial services. Abiona fears for the future of his business if the government implements a 5% tax for online sales.
A lot of businesses will have to close down, small-scale businesses. They are practically online. Almost everybody are online. So if at any point in time you have most having to pay taxes or having to, you know, make double taxes on top of transactions that they are doing, it doesn't make any good sense.
Technology companies in Africa already face infrastructure challenges, and the internet in some places is slow and expensive. A year ago, the Ugandan government imposed heavy taxes on social media use, forcing millions to abandon some platforms such as Twitter and WhatsApp. Ugandan authorities say they introduced the tax to curb idle talk, but some government critics viewed it as an effort to stop dissent. In neighboring Kenya, the government has been increasing taxes on mobile money transfers, and this month the Kenya Revenue Authority said it will start taxing many applications developed and downloaded in the country. And this month the Kenya Revenue Authority said it will start taxing many applications developed and downloaded in the country. The head of Kenya's Institute of Economic Affairs, Kwame Owino, says people will find ways to avoid paying taxes for using digital platforms.
So people might decide that, look, if you're going to tax too much my transfer of money from one person to the other, then people may go back to using the informal methods. So part of it is that transactions will go back down to levels. It might also affect savings in the formal area, in the sense that if you have to transfer money and all that, people might decide, look, let's do our mattress banking as we always did, because many people think that part of it is government is using it for social control and for surveillance. And I think that's the biggest risk.
With more countries taxing the use of technology, many economists and digital users say business growth could take a big hit. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A flash flood in Kenya's famed Hell's Gate National Park has killed 6 tourists and their driver, leading to temporary closure of the park. The victims included 5 Kenyans of Indian descent, an Indian national, and their Kenyan driver. Efforts were still underway today to retrieve the final body. The park in the Rift Valley, about 60 miles north of the Kenyan capital, was the location of the second Tomb Raider film, The Cradle of Life. A group of 13 tourists were visiting the area Sunday. 2 of them managed to escape and alert park rangers. The park is famous for its gorges, cliffs, and steam plumes from geothermal activity underground. 7 members of a church group died in 2012 when they were washed away by flooding in the same area. Since then, the park has created emergency exits. A team of researchers and humanitarian professionals has developed a unique approach to combat domestic violence in the refugee camp of Dolo Ado in Ethiopia. For VOA, Makrin Birungi just returned from Bokolomayo refugee camp and has this report.
Over the past month, 8 young Somali refugees have been trained and mentored to produce podcasts in the local language. Together with researchers on the team, they have been developing content they believe will be effective in changing the way domestic violence is viewed in their community. Podcaster Ikra Dagan is rehearsing her script and explains what the program is all about.
What I'm rehearsing is just the episode 16, that is Empowering Change. This is in good for our life, our society. So if I talk about the bystander, you don't look something who is victimized or who is violated. And instead of looking or just watching or listening, you have to do action and help our sisters and mothers and even our friends.
Mahad Noor, another podcaster, says the Unite for a Better Life podcasts address the factors that contribute to violence in the refugee camps and give practical advice for how to build healthy relationships.
Episode 10 talks about the violence. We first inform them what violence means, what causes, how can we mitigate, how can we reduce violence. And we give some messages, take-home messages, like violence is never acceptable. there's always an alternative. We also inform them that violence hurts everyone. There is no justification for violence.
The podcast tackles a broad range of themes, including understanding gender and gender norms, providing insights into healthy and unhealthy relationships, discussing sexuality and pleasure, and addressing chat, a plant that is widely chewed for cultural and social reasons and is linked to intimate partner violence. Belet Sayoum, the Humanitarian Assistance and Program Head at Administration for Refugee and Returnee Affairs in Bocolmayo Camp, hopes that the podcast will help reduce intimate partner violence in the refugee camps.
This podcast production will reach to the community through mass media. You know, it is even documented and then recorded at local language, which is easily understandable. So it is one of the major IEC mechanism, which is information, education, communication management system, to minimize and then mitigate any violence happening in the camp.
The podcast project is the brainchild of a team of researchers from Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, Addis Ababa University, and Women and Health Alliance Ethiopia. It builds on research being conducted in the camps since 2014. Vandana Sharma, the principal investigator of the research study, says there's a growing interest in using technology-based solutions to address intimate partner violence, especially in humanitarian settings.
Typically, programs addressing intimate partner violence involve in-person, participatory, or educational sessions. We believe that an approach such as the podcast series could have a much farther reach, as people could download the podcasts and share them peer-to-peer. In a humanitarian context, this means we could reach many people very quickly.
Negusi Deyesa of Addis Ababa University acknowledges that podcasts are a unique and promising intervention that can help relay important messages, change attitudes and behavior, and enable community members to unite for a better life. Makrin Birungi for VON News, Bocolmayo Refugee Camp, Ethiopia.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Ruhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, education has the power to transform the lives of people worldwide, especially in Africa. But often, educational practices are outdated. Rethinking education on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com.
The news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.